You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas that are shaping our patterns of consumption for the better. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Before we get into this great conversation with Kyle Chayka about minimalism, I wanted to talk about the new intro you just heard. If you're a subscriber to the podcast, you know we've talked to a lot of founders of brands, but also journalists and experts, authors, artists. And it's always been a struggle for me to describe what is this fuzzy blob of themes that we're all trying to explore here together. And it's not just about the direct-to-consumer landscape. I want to keep surprising you and finding people that are going to bring a fresh perspective to the conversation. And the phrase that I keep hearing in my brain is patterns of consumption. I've been fascinated by all the different ways that we as a society can improve our relationships with each other, with the earth, through the things that we make, the things that we buy, and what happens after we use them. We've had folks on the show who approach this from all sorts of different angles. How to make products that are more durable, how to make products that are less durable, that actually degrade purposefully. How do we make products that are more easy to repair, made from better materials, less wasteful? We've talked about supply chain transparency, long-term thinking, governance, inclusiveness. All of these themes are part of the new economy that we're trying to build together that is more symbiotic with the planet and more compatible with the long-term health of everyone who lives on it. So all this to say, with the beginning of this new decade, I want to keep together expanding our horizons, and I'd love for you to participate in that and share with us the creative, thoughtful people that you want to hear from, the ideas and themes that you're excited about, the new things that you're just discovering and want to understand better. So reach out to us. We're Lumi, L-U-M-I on Twitter. I'm Kepano on Twitter, K-E-P-A-N-O. That's a great way for you to get in touch with us and tell us what you're liking and what you want to hear more of. So without further ado, let's get into it. Kyle Chayka.
Hey.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you are, would you describe yourself mostly as a freelance journalist? That's your day job?
Yeah. So I do magazine writing. I write like features for websites and magazines. And then I have written this book. And this is my first book.
Yeah, so. We're going to talk about your book, Longing for Less, .. Living with Minimalism, which makes it sound almost like a condition. Like it's like, I have minimalism.
Yeah. I mean, we struggled for a long time with both the title and the subtitle. Like very important, you know, you can't, there's a temptation to have it be really simple, like just minimalism, but there's actually a lot of books that are just called minimalism. And you want to, you know, talk about minimalism, but not have it be limited to people's associations with the word minimalism. So we wanted to find a way to like evoke the idea without naming it too closely. And then the living with minimalism, yeah, it's like, it could be positive or negative. Like
right.
People want to live with minimalism. They want to like live minimally, but also it's this idea that we struggle with, I think.
I think the book tries to understand the appeal of minimalism but in all its forms. Like there's the capital M minimalism as an art movement. There's just the pursuit of trying to have less stuff. You've structured the book in these four parts.
Mm-hmm.
What I have them here, reduction, emptiness, silence, shadow. Is that what you were trying to do? You're trying to understand what it is, what the appeal, what the interest that people have had over centuries of this concept.
Yeah. So to figure out like why people are drawn to it and to show how people have been drawn to minimalism in many different times and places. Like I think it's so easy to look at minimalism, especially right now, and be like, oh, this is such a great different idea. Like what if we just threw out all of our stuff? And it's like, actually people have thought about that a lot before. And it's, you know, we've gone through this cycle quite a few times. And it's certainly a good idea, but it's worth looking at the history of it to understand like how it works, how it doesn't work.
I was excited to talk to you because, you know, we have authors and journalists on the show, but mostly we talk to a lot of brands that are thinking a lot about the patterns of consumption and how things are changing. And a lot of them, some of which you mentioned in the book, are thinking about minimalism almost as a strategy or the idea of helping people buy fewer better things. And there's a
the
lot
Kriana
of
slogan.
There's a lot of phrases and so you kind of go through a little bit of the history, but I wouldn't say it's a history. It's sort of like touching on a lot of different angles of it. And I found myself, especially in the early chapters, just always on the cusp, like, of thinking, oh, this person, and then you have that person mentioned on the next page, whether it's like Dieter yeah. Rams or Muji or all these kind of influences that have permeated the culture, Marie Kondo, who's been mentioned many times on the show now, from like the folks at Poshmark and ThredUp, who have, like, for them, it was a huge thing for their business because they sell secondhand products. And right, they talked a little bit about that in previous episodes. So this is not even a question. It's more trying to kind of give the flavor to people who are listening of what this book is about. What else were you trying to do with this?
I keep thinking about the structure that it exists in. And I think, like, the structure demonstrates what the book is trying to do. Or, like, I had to come up with that structure in order to do what I wanted to do, which was not to give, like, a linear history of minimalism, not to, like, say, is this good or bad, not to tell you how to organize your closet, but instead to, like, approach it from many different angles, as you said, and, like, evoke one part of the idea at a time, so that by the end of the book, you do get this perspective of minimalism, but a minimalism that is not just one thing or another. It's kind of a collection, a diffuse collection of all these different ideas and people and, like, moments in history and different places. So I guess, like, I really wanted to expand the idea of minimalism and, like, create a wider definition of what it is or what it could be.
I want to explore, like, how you changed as a person from writing this book, because it seems like you set yourself up as having been interested in minimalism, but then there is also a lot of critical aspects of how that word or that concept has evolved over time. And so, did you think of yourself as a minimalist before writing this book, and do you still?
I was always interested in minimalism. Like, my own background in writing and, like, research is in art history, so I had this sense of minimalism as, like, an art movement from the 60s and a word that was, like, often applied to design or architecture. But then, like, in 2015, 2016, you started seeing minimalism applied to so many other things, like the Marie Kondo cleaning your closet and, like, you know, everything from an apartment to a brewery to a beer to a skincare routine, like, everything is minimalist. Like, the book came out of that gap between those two things where I had this, like, sense of an aesthetic of minimalism, and it seemed to have become, like, it just became a shorthand for something. Like, I definitely identified myself or my taste with, like, that earlier minimalist aesthetic, like the artists and architects and stuff. So I wanted to kind of remind people of that and, like, bring them back to those original artists and, you know, architects and designers and writers who came up with these ideas originally, because that's what I felt the closest to. But, you know, like any millennial city dweller, like, I lived in New York for 10 years and I never owned that much stuff. I moved, like, 8 times. Like, in that sense, I totally identified with the minimalist lifestyle by default, essentially, because you don't have that much space. You can't own that much stuff. You have to be really choosy about what you keep around you. And that definitely helps me live more minimally, I would say.
What you're saying is already, I have, like, 7 different thoughts and I'm trying to figure out which one to go with. But I too have always, like, been of that mindset. And I went to school originally for biology, but always had, I did a minor in art, practical art, and then went into industrial design and all kinds of different things. But I remember, I don't think it was necessarily the first time I heard minimalist, but it was like a art class 101 type of thing that that we had. I'm trying to, like, piece this together because it's, like, such a faded memory, but we had an assignment which was to, like, essentially make a book with only dots and lines or, like, circles and things. We had a very limited, like, number of different things that we could do. And so half of my stuff was just, like, one dot in the middle of a page. And that was very different from what everyone else had come up with. And the teacher was like, "You're a minimalist." And I was like, "Really? What is that?" And I felt actually, like, comfortable with being labeled in that way. And I was like, "That's cool that someone else is doing that." And I don't know if that was exactly the seed of something, but throughout my life and career as a designer and human, I've always, like, looked for that idea of, like, less is more and how can we do more with fewer things. Now, I was trying to ask myself before you got here, like, how did I change from reading this book? And I'm not sure if I figured that out yet, because I just finished the book a few days ago. But it definitely attacked some of my beliefs in a way that I was not prepared for, but I actually really appreciated the challenge. And so I maybe it would be interesting to pick up on some quotes. I don't know if you have anything to say about my interpretation of it, but that was my personal journey, at least.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea of challenging what people think of as minimalism and maybe bringing it to something that's bigger than just the aesthetic choices. Like, yeah, like a single dot on a page is minimalist, but so is like not defining yourself as one thing or another. And, you know, maybe thinking about your surroundings in a different way. Like, I think we have this conception that the only minimalist things are like blank white walls and like mid-century modern furniture or something. But actually, like, to me, minimalism is much more about seeing something that you don't expect to be beautiful or pleasant or interesting, and then finding what is beautiful or interesting or pleasant about it.
Well, and the In Praise of Shadows, kind of, I think that's the last chapter. What Shadows is the title, but I think it draws on this great essay that I have a whole story about, like, my experience with that essay too.
It's a classic, like, design text.
Yeah.
Like, they teach it in art schools. It's great.
Yeah, everyone should read that. The way that I first heard that essay was, I was in Kyoto and just visiting. This was only a few years ago. And my co-founder at Lumi and I went, and it was the first time we went on vacation after, like, basically working nonstop for 7 years straight. So we went to Japan. It was everything that I could have hoped for. But we were in Kyoto in a house, like, designed by an architect that you can visit out there. I think it's called the Murien House or something like that. And she had just gotten AirPods. They had just come out. Again, we're living the full lifestyle.
Yeah, this is everything.
And we had downloaded, I had suggested this book to her, and she had downloaded the audiobook. So we shared a AirPod, like each one in one ear, and like walked around this house that was totally empty, listening to this book, which is all about kind of, I guess, drawing comparisons between Japanese and Western aesthetic tastes and how to build a house. So we're in a house looking at this, listening to this all at the same time. And it was so interesting. Like, it was just so fascinating. It was honestly one of the coolest things that I've ever done. It sounds really simple, but I would really recommend that to anyone who's just trying to understand. It just does a really good job of explaining something that seems so ephemeral, which is shadows and light.
Yeah, that's an amazing way to read it, like, experience it, because it is so, like, what I love about that essay is it's so perfectly evocative of various, like, experiences that you would have in a Japanese house or in, like, an old restaurant in Kyoto in the early 20th century. And the writer, Tanizaki, kind of goes through these things one by one that he thinks are really tasteful and cool, but that we've kind of forgotten about. Like, he describes, like, a single candle lit in a dark room, and he describes, like, looking into his dark miso soup and, like, seeing the ripples on the surface. And he, like, describes all of these tasteful aesthetic experiences that we kind of ignore or just, like, bowl over as we seek, like, greater light and grandeur and, like, powerful, like, you know, more literally powerful things.
And he was writing this for a Japanese audience. And so I think that at that time, there was this influence coming from the West of technology and different ways to do bathrooms and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the beginning is so great. Like, I think it's so iconic where he's like, you know, the fancier of traditional Japanese architecture, you know, must take great pains to, like, integrate Western technology into his house. And he's like, for example, my toilet.
Right.
Like, I wanted the toilet to be made out of nice, you know, warm wood. But, like, that seems unsanitary, kind of, like, and porcelain is so much better and more modern. But, you know, and he just keeps going.
By the
going,
end,
going.
It gets a little bit get off my lawn-y of, like, cities. What about crossing streets? Guys, this is... But at the beginning, it starts really strong and philosophical. And he takes examples from everyday life, like, you know, panes of glass versus, you know, doing it with rice paper. And all, kind of all of that kind of idea is just, as someone who's a white person coming from the Western kind of way of life, it was interesting for him to to read it from a Japanese point of view. And yeah. I found it was so fascinating.
Yeah, it's like the other side of the story, kind of.
Yeah.
It's like what you... He was writing it in 1927 or something. And this was as Tokyo was like completely changing. And neon signs were being lit. And like skyscrapers were going up. And there were loud, noisy trains everywhere. And he was like, I want to preserve the way that it was before, at least in this book, so that like we can think about maybe an alternative way of living or some like a modernity that is not Western, essentially.
Right. And yeah, because he sees it, I don't know if he would, he describes it necessarily in a colonial way exactly, but it's sort of like the, there's this, and I'm not going to remember the wording of it, but he talks about light bulbs as well as this sort of like, white people want everything to be lit at all times, and they never are satisfied with the brightness of an environment.
There's some line that's like, the Westerner seeks ever greater light
and
like, you know, destroys all of the shadows in a room. And that's what is aesthetically pleasing to us. But instead, we should like think about the shadows and think about, you know, the more subtle experiences that we have in space.
And I think that speaks to what you were describing as this is one of the ways that minimalism, it's like there's not a good other word for
it that
clicks for everyone right away, but how that word has so many different interpretations.
Yeah, and like different ways that it could be created. Like the, to me, like minimalism throughout the book is kind of about a way of paying attention rather than like a single aesthetic or like a style that you create. So like Tanizaki in that essay is really paying attention to like the texture of, you know, a wall that's being lit by a far off window or like the candle lit in the dark room. He's not just like, everything should be white. Like, I'm only going to hang one thing. Like, this is a much more like holistic idea of existing in the world and is not just about a homogenous like aesthetic.
And you go into Stoicism and some of the more that's a whole different angle. Maybe is a more abstract way of thinking about it too.
I mean with the structure of the book, there's those four chapters and the first one is called Reduction, and this was just about like the desire to live simply and like to get rid of things in your life, to like isolate yourself or like control your surroundings. So like the Stoics, who are really popular on the internet now, you know, were pioneers of this idea of just kind of like living with what exists and taking things as it comes, which is a kind of minimal attitude toward living, I think.
So one of the things I found the most compelling as a critique of minimalism, and there's a few quotes that I want to read.
Please.
One of them is, I think there's this critique, which is a little bit of, if you on an individual level are focused on creating this environment for yourself where you can sort of, I guess, put your head in the sand and like avoid the complexities and the darkness and difficulty and complexity and bad parts of what's going on, you can just sort of ignore them and not address the real problem. And one of the quotes you have is, your bedroom might be cleaner, but the world stays bad. And I thought I had to sit and think about that for a second. Minimalism can be a very, you know, highfalutin kind of like thoughtful exercise that you can get lost in without thinking about the practical realities of the world and how to actually solve the real problems for most people.
Yeah, like minimalism is often an abstraction, right?
Yeah.
It's not about like the humanity outside your window or like your kind of day-to-day experience of interacting with people or doing work or whatever. It's this like purely aesthetic thing that you try to like create in your own life and at home, you know, primarily to do with objects. It's almost a defensive posture.
Mm.
It's a way of narrowing your focus down to the things that are within your own grasp, within your own life. And certainly, like, it's an individualistic attitude very often because it's focusing on what's around you specifically. Like, you can't go outside and be like, I expect this whole city of LA to, like, become minimalist for me. But you can change, like, how you live at home or how you structure your own life. Yeah.
It's trying to control the things that you can control, which I guess is good and bad. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like the book is critical of minimalism, but I never think that it's like a bad attitude. Yeah. It's not like, it's not a negative posture necessarily, but I do want people to be like more conscious of what it does mean and doesn't mean. Like, and I don't think minimalism is like a structural political attitude. Mm. Like it does not, it's not about communal work. It's not about like changing power structures. It's like fundamentally about kind of increasing your pleasure of what's around you by narrowing it down and like trying to like pay attention to unique things.
You say that, but then I need to find this. I think I had it like bookmarked. I wasn't going to bring this one into the conversation, but there's Marxism is brought up at a certain point it's like, and I thought it was a very actually interesting like overlap where Marx was talking about something to the extent of, basically, when people get further away from the means of production, they lose consciousness of how the whole system works and appreciate it less or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, the fundamental Marxist thing is like so much of labor under capitalism is like alienated labor because we're not connected to the products of our labor. Like Marx is a great critic of what minimalism is now. Like,
here it is. Consumerism. Yeah, it. Consumerism causes a kind of alienation in the Marxist sense. When workers are separated from the products of their labor and compensated by an hourly wage, they can't find satisfaction in their jobs or the remainder of family life. It's interesting.
Yeah. So my interpretation of Marxist critique of minimalism is like of consumer minimalism.
Yes.
Is that it like reiterates our dependence on objects for our identities. Mm. So like even with Marie Kondo's Spark Joy thing, like you are going through your possessions one by one and figuring out which ones you identify with, essentially, right?
Yes.
But it's not about stopping your identification with the objects or like stopping. It's like a way of mitigating your consumerism, right? But it doesn't like tell you to start focusing on your family or like unionize your workplace or
well, so in the category of like, so there's definitely that axis of minimalism versus consumerism and materialism, like mm-hmm. that's one axis, as opposed to say like the minimalism versus ornamentation axis,
yeah,
which
yeah,
is like
yeah.
a more
the
aesthetic
style,
kind
yeah.
of axis. And in that versus materialism, you bring up a lot of interesting ideas. Another one that I thought was fascinating, which reminded me of a podcast that we did very early on with Kevin Kelly, who wrote a book, I think it's called The Inevitable. We talked about, he's written lots of books, but his most recent one was called The Inevitable. And he was a few years ahead of some of the on-demandification of everything, all of the sort of everything as a service. He talked in his book about, hey, someday you'll be able to rent furniture and like not have to own any furniture. And then like 2 years later, there's like 7 startups doing that. And I think you point to that as an example of it. Maybe it follows from that Marxist thinking of, here's another quote. It's easy to feel like a minimalist when you can order food, summon a car, rent a room using a single brick of steel and silicon, but really it's the opposite. We're taking advantage of a maximalist assemblage. Just because something looks simple doesn't mean it is. I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah, particularly with like the on-demand economy stuff, like just because the object is not like in your possession at all times doesn't mean you're not like relying on it. If you can have access to a car on demand with an app, like that doesn't mean you don't own it. I don't know. Like I think the sharing economy is like a different kind of ownership that can be just as like exploitative and problematic.
Well, it abstracts you away from the reality.
Yeah.
And so the more abstracted, so one way to be more minimalist is to be more abstracted away from the real thing. Mm. So you're controlling through a touchscreen a whole system of people
totally.
Infrastructure and supply chain that has to do all of that work for you. But it's easy, it goes back to your quote, it's easy to be minimalist if you're sitting there with a phone and you can press a button and all this stuff happens. But how connected are you? I think people have that critique of the modern farming system, for example. Like if you're not the person who has to butcher the pig, it's much easier to like, you know,
you ignore the messiness.
Yeah, you
of
ignore
the whole system.
It. And so it's out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah. You think of it as minimalist because it's just the action is contained within the touchscreen, right? You're like, mm-hmm. oh, I don't need to own a car. I can just like push the button. But like, yeah, you are taking advantage of this whole system of people and technology and like capital that then serves you up the car and that goes away when you don't need it. And I think that's like, we shouldn't think of that as simple, I guess. Like simplicity is so often a facade. Like very little technology and very little like consumer products are actually simple. The stuff still blows my mind, actually. Like when I when we talk about it or when I think about it, it's like the vast superstructure that surrounds us when we use technology is like the least simple thing that has ever been invented. And yet we so often think of like an iPhone as minimalist or like our apps as minimalist. Like,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, if somehow we had to go a day without the internet as a society, I mean, everything would break down.
Yeah. And that's like the minimalism that I try to get to in the book is more about like forcing that experience with the real world around you and like not mediating. Like the internet is a layer of mediation between ourselves and everything around us.
Yeah.
So I feel like the minimalist artists and writers and musicians that I get to in the book are like usually about removing that mediation and like trying to make you experience what's actually there in front of you without any like preconceived notions or like judgments on what you're experiencing.
It brings up an interesting question of like, what is more minimalist? To be completely self-reliant, like you live on a farm and you have an entire ecosystem of things where you can like feed yourself, feed your animals, grow a garden, and live in this like completely self-contained ecosystem that keeps you alive and keeps your whole family alive, or to live in a... Did you ever read The Machine Stops? Live in like a cube where you own nothing and press buttons that bring you things. So you don't have anything, but you rely completely on a whole ecosystem of stuff that is external to you that is like doing your bidding.
The latter has like a superficial simplicity and a superficial minimalism, right? Because you own nothing and all you're doing is the one action of like pushing the button. But like if we're talking about a kind of deeper minimalism about like paying attention to the world and like developing relationships and like really seeing what is in front of you, then definitely the farming thing is more minimalist. Like the sustainable structure is more minimalist.
It's like on the surface more complex for the individual, but like and I think that as a society, if we had to live that way, we just wouldn't be able to support the population that we have. And I have very mixed feelings about this.
Yeah. I know, like, I'm not a farmer. I'm not a back to the land person. I kind of don't like nature that much, to be honest. But I do like having a connection with the things around you, and particularly like appreciating the provenance of things, which like to me speaks more to like going to a farmer's market or like knowing who grows your vegetables or like who bakes your bread and like kind of being aware of the whole supply chain. Like to me, that's a more minimalist action because you are appreciating what's there and not just like hiding. You're not like, oh, I just push the button and it comes to me. You're like, oh, I know the people who do this and I care about each step.
Here's another aspect that's fascinating to me. There's a symbiotic relationship between minimalism and mass production where it's like not clear which one feeds the other, but it's there's a quote that I'll read, which is just minimalism is the perfect match for our age of mechanical reproduction, which it seems so obvious, but mechanical reproduction, mass production wants simple things that can be made in volume. And so if you can tie that to like an aesthetic and emotional desire for something that is simple, that works well together.
Yeah, it's like a cycle. It does like minimalism. I've often thought of this consumer minimalism as like the most scalable aesthetic solution for the world, kind of. Because it's like cheap to produce. You can make it out of anything. And it like applies well everywhere, kind of, as we see in this like global minimalist design aesthetic. And it's like, yeah, it adapts to mass manufacturing because like part of minimalism is appreciating the pre-made quality of an industrial good. So by focusing on some industrially made thing and appreciating it, you're like, you appreciate it wherever it appears. Like it kind of is good wherever you see it. And it's always the same because it's industrially made.
And I haven't vocalized these ideas before. So I'm like trying to think of them as I'm talking to you. But yeah. When I eventually, after thinking I would become a biologist, went to school for industrial design and graphic design, I was very attracted to modernism as an aesthetic and as a system of thought and philosophy for design. What you were saying reminded me of a quote from a famous Italian graphic designer, Massimo Vignelli, who talks about the life of a designer is a fight against ugliness. And I think his interpretation of a lot of that is around the aesthetic, creating simplicity out of chaos. And when you look at that school of design, the Bauhaus, and all the way to like modern versions of that, I mean, a lot of the like aesthetic today that you see in modern simple minimalistic websites kind of has roots in that. There was a pursuit that happened to be compatible with mass production. I almost don't like that about that. I want it to be because they were fighting against, why is it that, you know, if you go to like Versailles or something like that, and there's like just everything is completely ornate or Baroque or decorated, we can't all like have a hand-carved wood chair of that like degree. And so mass production and these ideas have brought up the bar for the majority of people. I don't know. I'm searching for something here and I'm not sure what.
So to me, what it makes me think of is like, so the Bauhaus was about trying to invent an idea of beauty that was suited to mass production. Like their argument was like, just because something is mass produced does not mean it has to be ugly or cheap or like not effective. And so they were designing for like the aesthetics of factory production and like hard edges and metal and like trying to create an appreciation for all of those qualities, which they succeeded at incredibly. It's kind of the dominant aesthetic of modernity, essentially, like through today, no matter that it was like invented in the 20s. And I think that's the other weird like split in your mind, is that we think of these aesthetics as timeless and kind of like ahistorical. And yet they were very much a product of their times, because those designers and architects were like grappling with the advent of mass production and with industrialization, and they invented a solution for it in their own time. Like, but now we still use it. Like, we haven't come up with a better idea.
I think that there was a reaction to that. And if we go to, you know, art school 101, you know, you've got postmodernism, you've got the Art Deco, you've got things that are styles that emerged either as a reaction or complement to modern aesthetic that tried to make an argument for why, you know, ornamentation might be good, or you know, why we can, even with mass production, layer in more personality into the world around us.
Right. I think like the modernist ideal was like the perfect thing for all people, right? Like we can
the
find
best for the most
solution.
For the least.
Yeah, the Eames slogan. And then with like Art Deco, whatever, there's another idea that's like, oh, like mass production doesn't just have to mean simplicity and like Bauhaus austerity. It can be like, we can mass produce whatever aesthetic we want. But the problem is like, we still haven't gotten beyond those ideas, I guess. I was obsessed with 3D printing briefly, as many people were, before it kind of like the utopian dream faded out. But like the next step theoretically is like a mass production that doesn't have to be the same for all people,
right?
And so until we reach that, like, we've kind of hit the end of a mass produced aesthetic, I think. I don't know what further innovation
that's interesting
there is.
That actually goes to another Kevin Kelly book. He's one of my favorite authors, which is Out of Control. I don't know if you ever read that one. It's really good, but he talks about a future in which things are grown instead of made, I guess, is like a line that I remember from that book. And I think that speaks to what you're describing, which is like a mass personalization or something that is more organic and natural as an outcome or a product of still a mass produced thing, but a mass personalized thing.
Yeah. Like, you want something that responds to your own tastes to some degree. But I don't know that we have aesthetics that work for that system yet. Like, we don't know.
I guess so. I mean, I don't know, but is that what most people are looking for? Are they more comfortable with you know, the best for the most for the least, the choice where they don't really have to think that much about it and can buy something or use something that works well, looks good, does what it needs to do, but we all use the same thing. Are we converging towards like the most optimal thing that satisfies the needs of most people?
Yeah. I mean, I do think that's the impulse of like, oh, I want to buy the perfect minimalist lamp that's like very tasteful and looks, you know, it looks good wherever I put it. I can like move it around. I've like bought a great product that works for me and works for many other people.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think we get bored of that. You know, I have to speak from my own perspective. Like the people who do culture writing and are critics, I'm like, you know, I make money based on my own taste, essentially. Like,
yeah,
I'm kind of bored. I want the next thing beyond that. I don't want the perfectly optimized tool. I want like a thing that is more about my own taste and more specific. Like, I bring up Donald Judd's like spaces, the artist Donald Judd, like built a lot of his own houses, like, you know, renovated his giant loft in Soho. And the amazing thing about his spaces is that it's so clear that he's decided on every single thing in them and nothing is generic. Like,
yeah,
he was not about to like go buy a minimalist lamp. He was either going to like find one made by an artist who's a friend of his or design one himself or like find something that's underappreciated and like reframe it as a valuable aesthetic experience.
But that takes work.
Yeah, it takes work and time and money and like
taste
capital.
And yeah.
But like, hopefully, I don't know if we need to find our way past like the minimalist thing somehow. I think it's kind of bound to happen. Like, minimalism is a trend that has become extremely popular, and you can kind of see it all around.
It's possible that we're gearing towards a polarization in that respect, where there's, you know, there's either the thing like an iPhone or flagship Android phone or whatever it is, where it's like, this is the one thing if you're going to buy a phone. And then there's the extreme personalization and it's just nothing in between.
Yeah. And like, if 90% of your stuff is that the one best thing, like the wire cutter pick
the wire
for
cutter,
every single thing, I think that's great. Like, I have a lot of that stuff myself. But then I think the sad thing is if 100% is that, if like you are not going out and like figuring something out for yourself or like trying to develop a specific taste or interest in your aesthetic experience, like, it's like, if you pay enough attention to the stuff around you, you don't just want the same thing as everyone else.
Well, it's interesting. About 2 years ago, I think me and Caitlin, our head of editorial, were thinking about a blog post that we never got around to about hero products, which was just like a phrase. And I've seen it used in other places. But a lot of the brands that were coming out like 4, 5, 6 years ago had this philosophy of like, we're going to make the best thing and there's just going to be only one. And so you would have like, Casper was like, we've looked at all the mattresses in the universe and there's only one that everybody needs and this is the one. And now you go to Casper's website and they have 7 different mattresses because...
I'm like, 8 pillows and a lamp and like all this other stuff.
Because it's normal because they were a startup that only could afford to make one mattress. And so they made the best, like the middle of the bell curve, the best mattress that they could that would meet the most needs. But then people said, hey, I want one with springs or I want one that's cool and I want one that's warm and I want this and that. And so they were like, okay, there's a market for all of these different kinds of mattresses.
Yeah.
And so we gave up on the blog post because we were like, is this even a thing or is this just a limitation of how like to start a company, you have to make some choices?
Yeah, you need the flagship product. I mean, it's like Chanel and bags or whatever, or like some... I mean, I guess couture fashion is like an interesting parallel to this where you are making the radical art product that's like almost no one can afford, almost no one can wear. But then the like mass produced products like bags or perfumes or whatever are given more meaning by the backdrop of these like super custom things. So I don't know, when Casper starts coming out with like artist remixed mattresses or whatever, then we'll know that has happened.
Yeah, what is the what do they call that in cars as well?
The BMW art cars.
it's a halo product, I think.
That's
a concept, and I think
so hero and halo products.
Well, yeah, I think the difference is like a hero product is maybe like, yeah, your flagship, which is intended to be the one that is like the best one across the board. I don't know why my brain went to like Super Mario when you select a character in like Mario Kart. Yeah. It's like the default middle of the road, good at everything.
The three stars down, yeah, down the middle.
Three stars down the middle. Not specifically weird in any way, but it's good for most people. And that's like a good place to start. If you're starting a new company, you probably want to make that thing first. And then you can go into like the weird thing that only 10% of your audience want, but maybe they're going to really love that thing. The Halo product is more like what you're describing with high fashion, where it's like, or the sport car, where it's like not maybe even a product that can be sold at all. It maybe is a concept thing that's never even going to be sold, but it creates some sort of allure. And people have criticized that approach as well because it alienates the consumer, and they never get to buy that thing that doesn't exist. It sounds so cool and yet doesn't exist.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I mean, this is all the intersection of minimalism and consumerism is so fascinating because like minimalism is an anti-consumerist attitude and like, but it's so often adapted to consumerist ends. Like
that's fascinating. And I think a lot of the folks who have been guests on this show would point to like that kind of attitude being something that their customers are looking for. They're looking for something that is going to simplify. I remember this study where like they showed like Russian people like the toothpaste aisle at the grocery store in America, and they were like so overwhelmed and confused and scared that they were like, this is too much. Yeah. I just want the one government toothpaste.
yeah, like eliminating choice is another product that yes. you can sell, and like the promise that you've designed something carefully and like embedded a lot of thought into it makes a good product. Like everything should be like that, right? The problem is that most things have not been like that. But then you have all these various brands competing to be like the one thing.
The one thing that is
not everyone can have designed the best one thing. Like there is only one. But I don't know. This conversation also reminds me of how like a lot of my friends who are in media or, you know, in design or whatever have taken up ceramics lately for whatever reason, which is like my parents are ceramic engineers. Like they were doing this stuff in the 70s along with like making their own yogurt or whatever. And I think it's this like desire to be closer to our material culture and to like interact with it on a one-to-one level and like make the thing yourself that you use in the world, like to have more of a relationship with your coffee cup or something because you've made it. It's like tactile, direct experience. I'm like, I don't know. Having more of that seems more appealing to me than having everyone buy Muji mugs, which are amazing. Like I love Muji mugs, but if everyone made their own mugs, like we'd probably live in a better world.
That's an interesting... Probably, I think that's like 90% correct. I'm trying to think of a counter argument to that. But
if we had the time to make our own mugs and the materials and the like leisure,
it's a very Maslow kind of like we're living at the top of the pyramid right now. Like some people just need a mug,
right?
And so like, how can I make the mug that most exemplifies my self-actualization beliefs? Like,
well, this is totally the next level of minimalism, is like the hyper customization or like the DIY quality of like, you know, we can go back to Japanese aesthetics again, the like appreciating the wabi-sabi handmade quality of something and like showing that you have great taste and you've exercised your great taste by like making your own space, making your own tools, making your own products. I'm really interested in things that enable more of that. I don't know what form that takes exactly, but...
I was mind blown by a fact that you put in the book that the average American home has 300,000 different items. Because like a mug is one of those 300,000 things. So what's the desire for every single one of those items to be, you know, handmade and perfect?
Right, you can't make it all.
Self-actualizing you. Like, what is the, you know, I have a bunch of different socket wrenches. Like, do I need them to be the most personal wrench that I can have?
Yeah, not everything can be personal. And that's like a critique of this whole idea, obviously.
Maybe if the wrench is like your thing.
You take pride in your wrench. It's like,
no, if you're using wrenches all day long and that's the thing that you, I think where mugs make sense is we all drink out of a mug every single day. And so if you can have a relationship with the mug that you made, then it makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if we'll go through something with material culture that we've gone through with cooking and food, where like we're now super obsessed with the provenance of our food and the like ways that we cook it and the tools that we use to make it. And there's like a very, we have a more direct relationship with food as like an aesthetic experience than we used to as Americans, I think. And so could that happen with material culture too? Like that, I would be really interested in that.
So there's a quote from Rem Koolhaas, who's an architect that you mentioned. He talks about this pervading kind of overall aesthetic and design sense establishing itself within the city as well, not just the objects. And he describes it as the generic city. The generic city is equally exciting or unexciting everywhere. This flattening occurred because of technology. The generic city is what is left after large sections of urban life crossed over to cyberspace. I felt that last year when I went to New Orleans for the first time, and I was like, oh, this is a place. It has its own
it's
feeling.
A unique place.
And I was like, I actually grew up in Paris, which is a place, and I lived there until I was 17 and then moved to the States and different places. But my mom is American. I have to like give the disclaimers before people ask questions. But that sense of place and uniqueness and personality is disappearing, it seems like, all over the place. And it's about globalism. It's about the internet and how we've created this like way to share ideas like that spread very easily across the world without any boundaries. But I guess that critique is like, what have we lost? And I think you're talking about it from the perspective of objects and material culture, but also societally and like in the environments that we live in.
Yeah. It affects everything. Like, I think, I mean, I love that Rem Koolhaas quote. And I think like Rem Koolhaas's essays, The Generic City and Junk Space, are like, they were written in the mid 90s, like what, 20 plus years ago, like going on 25. And they were so prophetic, like in terms of what is happening to our material culture. Cause he's talking about architecture specifically, like, every airport looks the same, therefore like more places look the same than they look different. But we've like moved on from architecture to the objects in our interiors, to like our decorating schemes, our like aesthetic desires are, you know, shaped maybe more by Instagram or social media or whatever than they're shaped by like our day-to-day physical surroundings. So like New Orleans is great because it has this real identity and this real history and rootedness. Paris is great because it has this like rooted quality, or like Kyoto has this hyper specificity. But then the places that are less specific, or like that are kind of building up in the 21st century, don't have that like deeply rooted aesthetic source. And so Koolhaas is kind of trying to theorize like, what is the generic? Like, we can't escape the generic. Like, we can't fight it because there's just so much space and buildings to fill it. But maybe we can somehow understand it as a human product and like be aware when we encounter it.
I always think about this in biological terms, because it's like, it's inefficient to be different. But
that's such a good phrase. Wow.
It's inefficient to be different. But on the other hand, if you're so monoculture that you like don't have diversity within your population, you're more likely to be decimated.
Yeah, like one thing can take you out.
Yeah. And so you need that cross-pollination. You need that genetic diversity to have innovation and have resiliency as a population, like in the biological term. And I think that finding that balance is something that we're really struggling with right now. And it's a fairly new problem. Like it's come up over the past 100 years or so. And I think we're like right at the intersection where now we've added the internet, which is like warp speed on top of that, because now ideas can cross-pollinate across the whole entire world. And I think we're just trying to, make sense of all of it.
Yeah, we're trying to make sense of this like hyper-globalization and like understand what hyper-globalization does to culture. And, you know, I think we're only starting to feel that now. Like the way that I can more easily see like what a graphic designer in Tokyo is doing than like knock on my neighbor's door is a crazy experience. Like I'm more influenced by some guy on Instagram in Tokyo than I am like what's going on down the block in some ways.
Yeah, we talked about that on the last episode is the Marshall McLuhan like global village where it's now you're just your peers are not necessarily the people physically around you, but the people that are around you from a mindset standpoint or from a, these are the people that you follow on Instagram or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I've always written about Airbnb in that way. That forms this like kind of global community and that passes ideas around very quickly about interior decorating and about food and space and like the lifestyle that we live in. So like even the loft that we're in right now, like you can go on Instagram and find this loft in every major city across the world.
And if you want to go stay in whatever city anywhere in the world, you can like stay in a place that feels just like where you came from.
Yeah. And I think that's like I want that as much as anyone. Like I love generic Airbnbs. I think they're so fun. But then it makes me scared in like a long-term sense or like just in a, I can't comprehend the scale of this, that like suddenly more places around the world are more the same. Like we as upwardly mobile, like creatively minded people have this like kind of generic desire for industrial reuse aesthetics and like exposed brick. Like what does that mean for the future? That, you know, are we losing all of that local culture and those local sensibilities, or are they being translated into some kind of like hyper scaled generic global cultural idea? I have no idea.
One of the new things that has happened over the past couple years, and I notice it more and more as I'm like walking my dog in the morning, is like everyone's wearing AirPods and everyone's like in their own like virtual reality bubble, even when they're like walking down the street where they're just like listening to this podcast that we're recording right now. And just like, it's so meta that we're like,
right. I love the meta shit. Like the meta stuff is the best stuff, I think. Yeah, I guess like the degree to which you can control your experiences and your like,
you can really isolate yourself.
Yeah.
Completely.
Which is not ideal.
You talk about that. I think that silence chapter kind of covers a little bit of that, which is like controlling our inputs, and the ultimate version of that is the Matrix or virtual reality, and you're just plugged into something that's feeding you, and you can imagine now wherever you live is just whatever you want.
Right. And we fake this well enough just by looking at our phones all the time. Like
yeah, pretty much.
It's like I don't really listen to podcasts walking around. I don't listen to music walking around, but I do stare at my phone all the time. So it's just like, you know, visual immersive experience that I'm always reading something online or like looking at my Instagram and blocking out like what's actually next to me.
What's the overlap between that and minimalism? Because I think part of it is like the blocking of the outside world and controlling your inputs has a minimalistic philosophical kind of basis that, or psychological basis that's interesting. But what are we saying here? Are we down a rabbit hole?
Well, the bad form of minimalism, I think, is about controlling what's around you and forcing everything to conform to one standard. Being like, okay, the only aesthetic that I like is the blank white walls and the mid-century furniture and whatever. But I think giving up that control is more aesthetically satisfying and is more creative and interesting. I think like that's what the original minimalism was about, like giving up the control, encountering what's around you on its own terms. And I want to get back to that. And I want, when people should read the book, and like when they say minimalism, they should think that instead of thinking of like the one generic aesthetic.
What makes you hopeful about anything in the future?
What makes me hopeful? I don't know, like art makes me hopeful. I think artists are the first people to get bored.
Yeah.
And designers come after, unfortunately. Like art
doesn't have to suffer from the requirements of mass production.
Right. Yeah. Like user experience is not the point of art, right? The art is supposed to make you uncomfortable and like challenge your notions. Whereas design and products and business and like writing to a large extent is meant to like treat you nicely and like nicely guide you through something. But like every time I see good art or like an artist doing an interesting thing, I'm like, there's always a future. Like we never hit the end of culture, no matter how much we talk about it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we're all, when I say all, I mean, all of the like privileged people listening to this podcast right now, wanting to, you know, surround ourselves with exposed brick or whatever it is. But that is like a sediment that is being added on top of like a history of culture that was developed in a place. And there are new blank canvases that are popping up. I think about this all the time when it comes to like malls and parking lots. Mm. Like malls and parking lots are the like brick buildings of 50 years from now. Because they're going to be abandoned and weird and stuff will have moved out of there. And what artists and creative people do with those physical places is going to be fascinating. Because we're going to live in a world 50 years from now where like transportation is going to be completely different and we're probably not all going to have our own cars and stuff like that. So what are we going to do with all this space that we've dedicated to like big cement structures? Like creative people are going to figure that out.
Yeah.
They're going to do something
like
interesting
that's super
with
that. Exciting. Like yeah. Donald Judd in the 50s,
startup
60s.
Offices are going to be in parking lots.
Yeah. I mean, malls are great startup incubators. Yeah. I think like, as you said, there was this minimalist reimagining of industrial space in the 60s. And like, that's what brings us industrial lofts and like the kind of office aesthetics that we have now. But like, we've done that, like it's over. Mm-hmm. So now what is there out there that can be reclaimed and rethought of? And like minimalism was about seeing the things that looked wrong or looked bad and like seeing what could be done with them. It's not just about reproducing what we already know to be interesting. So that, like the malls is a great example. Parking lots are a great example. Highways, like weird spots of non-beautiful nature. I feel like we can find new spaces to rehabilitate.
I'm hopeful for Gen Z and Gen Alpha. The kids, I feel like the kids are all right. They're gonna come up with some weird ass stuff because they're growing up in the world where they just live in this world that is global and connected and everything is available whenever you need. We're all getting used to it. We're old and weird already and we're just trying to deal with what happened to us. But they're
coping.
Living in that world as a artistic canvas. And I think there's a lot of stuff that will come out of that over the next 10 years as they become part of the working age and professionals and creating the new version of the world that we're going to be living in.
Yeah, it is amazing. And like I think also the decline in gatekeepers for cultural production and like college, maybe not necessary. Like,
we'll see.
You know.
Yeah, I agree.
That stuff is super interesting to me. The fact that anyone can put anything out into the world is like really hopeful.
Yeah, I agree with that. You should go check out the art gallery next door. I feel like you would really enjoy it. Hauser Wirth is...
Oh, yeah. It's a huge minimalist behemoth of a space. Yeah. That's like an art gallery as a urban destination. Like, there's a restaurant in there. Like,
I know. Well...
They're crazy.
People should go buy the book. We'll plug it one more time. Where should people go? Is it anywhere books are sold? Or?
Yeah, anywhere books are sold. Call your bookstore. Tell them you want 10 copies of it. Develop these in-person relationships.
The longing for less, by Kyle Chega. And people can find you on Twitter. And you're also writing on a lot of different... Where do you write the most lately? It's been kind of all over the place.
Yeah, I write for a lot of places. I did this big feature for Vox.com about tourism in Iceland that I think reflects some of these themes. I'm writing an essay for the Times magazine right now. I don't know, like follow me on Twitter. I think that's the raw feed right there. Like,
yeah.
You'll get everything.
We'll put the link in the show notes. It's CHAYKAK on Twitter. Well, thank you. This was enlightening, and I feel like I learned something about myself, but I don't know what yet. I need to meditate and distill this somehow.
Yeah, it's like minimalism is... This is another thing that I've said a lot, is like minimalism is not an answer. It's a way of asking questions.
Okay.
And so you just end up with more questions. Like that's what should happen, I think.
I hope that the people listening to this will share with us on Twitter what they figured out about themselves and their companies and their things that they're doing and their the meaning of their life based on this conversation. I'd love to hear from you. So please tweet at us your point of view on this whole conversation. Thank you, Kyle.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, if you got something useful out of it, I would love to hear what that was. Consider writing a short review, could be just a sentence long, by going to iTunes and searching for Well Made. I want to hear it all. I want to hear good, bad. I want to hear your constructive criticisms. I am just trying to make this show as useful as possible for you. So tell us what you think. That is the very best way that you can support the show. Thanks, and see you next time.